we are pleased to hold another military history presentation to commemorate more of our military heritage, and in particular, honour those who have served and made the ultimate sacrifice. The Korean War began on the 25th of June 1950, when North Korean troops invaded South Korea. And in July 1950, there were two Royal New Zealand Navy frigates dispatched to support the United Nations police action in Korea. Recruiting began for K-Force in New Zealand at about that time, and in conclusion, on the 5th of August, some 5,982 New Zealanders volunteered. In fact, 2,000 of them on the first day, which is quite remarkable. Eventually, 1,100 K-Force recruits undertook their training in New Zealand, with the main body leaving Wellington on the ship named the Ormond, and they reached Busan on the 31st of December 1950. The 16th Field Regiment, Royal New Zealand Artillery, who are now in Linton Camp, fired their first rounds in the Korea War in January 1951. There were four other Royal New Zealand Navy frigates involved in the conflict until around 1954. Now, our speaker tonight is going to tell us a little bit more about the detail of this 70-year war, but the war continued on until an armistice was actually signed on the 27th of July 1953, with over 6,000 New Zealand Armed Forces personnel serving in K-Force across all three services. And many of them actually remained in theatre until the 27th of July 1957. 45 New Zealand personnel were killed in the Korean War, including one from Palmerston North, Mr. R. MacDonald from Longburn. The conflict also led to the signing of the ANZUS Treaty on the 1st of September 1951, and it's great to see a number of local K-Force visitors here tonight. Now, our speaker tonight, Dr. Ian McGibbon, is going to tell us more about the war and New Zealand's involvement in this conflict, and his presentation is entitled Perspectives of a 70-Year War, a consideration of the origins and course of the war and reflections on his visit to the demilitarized zone last year. Now, Ian is an expert on the Korean War. He's researched and written many articles and books on the subject during his career as a historian. He holds a D.Litt from Victoria University, and I'm pleased to say is an honorary sapper. Ian was the chief historian for the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, and it has written many books on a wide range of military, political, and other historical topics. And we're delighted to have him here to share his knowledge and observations tonight. So please welcome Ian McGibbon.
Thank you, James. I'd like to start by acknowledging the presence here of two Korean veterans, Alan Cull, who helped me a lot while I was working on the official history of the Korean War, especially with the wonderful collection of photographs that he has of our troops in Korea, and Tony Smith, who served in 163 Battery. So actually being at the events is much better than reading about them and writing about them. And I hope that what I say tonight will won't grate with you from what you remember from your own experiences. I'm going to talk about Korea, but I'm conscious that today is the anniversary of the armistice in 1918, which ended the First World War, and at least on the Western Front, and I think we should remember the 18,000 soldiers that didn't return from the First World War. The Korean War was also prolonged, just over three years, and it also ended in an armistice. So although it was confined to one country, the actual death in Korea during those 3 years was on a First World War scale, although many of them were civilians. But from New Zealand's point of view, our casualties were mercifully few. As Joe said, I'm going to talk about the 70th anniversary of the war, 25th of June this year. I want to talk about why the war happened, what was its course, and what was its outcome. We hear a lot about the Korean War, but most people now don't have a great understanding of what actually happened in the war. And if you don't understand that, it's difficult to understand why it's so hard to resolve the problem of Korea because of the number of powers that were involved. And I'll end by talking about the state of the war today, because the Korean War has not ended. It's still, there's only been an armistice. There's never been a peace settlement. They tried in the 50s, but it was another deadlock. So after 47 years, we're still waiting for the resolution of the Korean War. Anyways. So the Korean War actually comprised three attempts to unify the Korean Peninsula by force. The first one was by the North Koreans, the second by the United States, and the third by the Chinese. Conflict began as a war between two small states and ended as a proxy contest between two great powers. Some people may dispute whether China was a great power in 1950, but in the context of this war, it certainly was a great power. So what the central question is, why was there a war in Korea? The outbreak of the war in 1950 arose from three fundamental causes. First was the arrangements that were made at the end of the Second World War for the occupation of the peninsula. The second was decolonization. And the third was the Cold War, which developed straight after the Second World War. Korea was a colony of Japan from 1910 to 1945. When the Japanese government at last surrendered following the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, their troops were still occupying Korea. The Russians had declared war on the 9th of August and then poured down into Manchuria and were heading in the direction of Korea. There was no doubt that if nothing had been done, the Russians would have occupied the whole of the Korean Peninsula. However, there was rapid diplomacy between the Russians and the Americans. An agreement was reached that both countries would share the occupation of Korea. And they settled on the 38th parallel as the border between the two occupation zones. So the Soviet Union basically penalized itself in a sense because it could have occupied the whole peninsula. But it was hoping, well, this is what people assume, it was hoping that it would get involvement in the occupation of Japan, perhaps by occupying Hokkaido in the north. That was a mistaken assumption on their part because the Americans were never going to let the Russians occupy any part of Japan. But it is an explanation why the Soviet Union didn't just keep driving down to Busan. After about a month, American troops arrived in Korea and occupied the peninsula south of the 38th parallel. The key thing to remember is that the 38th parallel is just a line on the map. It wasn't a border that was based on any defensive elements. It cut through territory just in a straight line. So this was important when the war actually started. The second thing that caused the war was decolonization. The Koreans were intensely nationalist. They hated being occupied by the Japanese, and the hatred or the prejudice or the, what's the right word, continues even today. Koreans are still very anti-Japanese because of the occupation. There were guerrilla movements on the peninsula during the Japanese occupation of Korea. One who claimed to be part of that resistance was Kim Il-sung, a very shadowy figure who appeared in Korea with the Soviet armies. He was very unclear about where he was born. Propaganda then developed as another narrative. It's very hard to reach the truth about Kim Il-sung. There were other Koreans in the south, the southern part of the peninsula, who were also involved in anti-Japanese activities. Kim Koo and another Kim. But there was also an expatriate Korean, Syngman Rhee, who spent a long period in the United States as an exile from Korea, who returned to Korea following the US occupation of the southern part of the peninsula. So there were a lot of questions about how was Korea going to be restored to independence. The United Nations had just set up a trusteeship system under which Samoa, our possession in the Pacific, was put, and various other places. When it was suggested that Korea could be put under the trusteeship regime, Koreans, to a man, rose up in anger because they didn't want to be equated with places that were like African colonies. They felt that there was a demeaning their ancient civilization, and I'm sure they were right. Overlaying all of this was the Cold War, which developed between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies in the 1940s. And this affected the efforts to unite the two zones of Korea in the late 40s. What happened in the end was that the United States and the Soviets both established administrations in their own zones. The North Korea was led by Kim Il-sung, and South Korea was led by Syngman Rhee. So what happened was that two antagonistic regimes were brought into existence, both claiming to control or have jurisdiction over the whole peninsula. This was a recipe for a war, if ever there was one. But there were clashes all the time along the 38th parallel. Men were being killed, northerners, southerners, for about 2 years. But nobody really thought there would be a war, because the Soviet Union controlled the north, as the Western people assumed, and the Americans would keep the South Koreans under control. And that was one of the problems. The South Koreans weren't given the tanks and artillery that they needed, because the Americans were afraid that they may attack the North. In the West, Kim Il-sung was regarded as a puppet of the Soviet Union, so it was assumed that Joseph Stalin would make sure that Kim didn't actually attack the South. He actually tried several times to get permission to do that, but was forbidden several times. Kim was a determined white man, and in the late 1949, time seemed to have come. The momentum seemed to have shifted to the communists. The Soviets had just exploded an atomic bomb, and the People's Republic of China had been proclaimed in Beijing. So he went to Moscow and asked Stalin if he could invade South Korea, and Stalin this time said yes, as long as you send us 10,000 tons of tungsten, like the gangster boss, quid pro quo. So he said also that Kim should consult Mao Zedong, make sure the Chinese also were happy with this. There's a good deal of communist miscalculation here. The first one was they didn't expect the United States to react if North Korea invaded the South. Dean Acheson, Secretary of State, had given a speech in January 1950 in which he said, well, he implied that Korea, South Korea, was not part of the United States defense perimeter in the Pacific. Apart from that, Stalin and Kim presumably assumed that the North Korean invasion would succeed very rapidly and the North Koreans would be in Busan before the United States could actually react. Once the war started, there were suggestions that the South Koreans had attacked the North, and the North had then invaded the South. This is a typical Nazi tactic. When the war started, the Second World War started, the Nazis claimed that Poland had attacked Germany, and Germany had invaded Poland in retaliation. And the North Koreans used exactly the same line, and academics in America took it up. So there was quite a debate, which actually went on for 40 years until Soviet Union fell and people could actually read what had gone on in Moscow in 1950. And then we found out that Kim had got permission from Stalin. Sometimes you have to wait a long time before details come out. Unlike what the communists thought, the United States responded immediately, both militarily and diplomatically. There were American forces still in Japan and Australian forces, so those forces were rapidly sent across to Korea. They were unprepared, they'd been in a cushy number in Japan for a number of years, they weren't battle-hardened, so they suffered quite a lot of casualties. They met the North Koreans coming south somewhere between Seoul and Busan, the port at the bottom, and they managed to help the South Koreans to stop or blunt the North Korean advance. But more important, the United States went to the United Nations. It was a fortuitous moment because the Soviet Union was so angry at the nationalist Chinese still sitting on the Security Council that they were boycotting the Security Council because of the failure to seat the communist regime in Beijing. So the United States put forward a resolution calling for the North Koreans to halt their invasion. Nothing happened. So 2 days later, they called on all members of the United Nations to support South Korea. This was a diplomatic triumph for the United States because it immediately put the North Koreans at a total disadvantage. Another resolution formed the United Nations Command, which still exists today, and command of that command was delegated to the United States, and President Truman appointed General Douglas MacArthur as the chief commander-in-chief. Now MacArthur was already in Japan as the supreme commander there, and he had a reputation as a general who mounted amphibious operations. But the main point is it was a great diplomatic triumph for the United States. And the Soviets realized their mistake quite quickly and were back in the Security Council before you could blank. And of course, from then on, they could veto any resolution that they didn't agree to. So there's some of the American troops advancing north in 1950. New Zealand was one of the 16 states that agreed to help South Korea. The resolution was on the 28th, the same day that news of it arrived in Wellington. Prime Minister Holland, Sidney Holland, decided on the spur of the moment, according to one of the officials, to commit two frigates. He did it without consulting cabinet, but of course he knew that the cabinet would agree. I'll explain the reasons shortly. But a month later, New Zealand offered 1,000 strong ground force on 26th of July. Interesting time because the government heard that the British and the Australians were both going to announce, and Sidney Holland rushed to get his announcement out first. I don't know why he was quite so determined, but he achieved his object because Australia and New Zealand both announced their ground force at 7 p.m. on the 26th. 7 p.m. in Canberra is 2 hours after New Zealand's 7 p.m. K-Force had to be recruited, trained, and then equipped and sent to Korea. So it didn't actually leave New Zealand until the 10th of December from Wellington. And it is notable because it's the last expeditionary force that New Zealand has committed. Boer War, or we shouldn't call it that, the South African War, two world wars, and then Korea. After that, New Zealand has committed troops to wars, but they've always been regular soldiers of the New Zealand Army, rather than a force recruited from the street. There were a number of regular soldiers, but most of them were like Alan and 1,000 others. Some people had service before, but basically they were regular soldiers. Now, in this decision to send our forces, the British response was very important. It wasn't until Sidney Holland heard that the British were committing their Far Eastern Fleet to the UN command that he rushed to send our two frigates, and the frigates joined the British frigate squadron, and that's how they participated in the war. So it was quite a comfortable arrangement for New Zealand. And the ground force, which was mainly an field artillery regiment, became part of a British Commonwealth brigade. So that helped us a lot because we were operating in the same doctrine and equipment as the other troops around us. If they'd been committed to an American regiment, it would have made it quite difficult. Oh, there's a cartoon that appeared at the time. The day that K-Force actually entered the camp. Okay, so we'll talk about the course of the war now. I mentioned about the North Koreans were coming south. They captured Seoul in 3 days. So they came down south. You can see the little area at the south of the peninsula. That's the Busan, what's called the Busan Perimeter. That's where the Australians, Americans, and some British, because the British came in there as well from Hong Kong, and the South Koreans stopped the North Korean advance. So there was just a tiny little bit of South Korea that was unoccupied by the North Koreans. As I said before, MacArthur was an expert at amphibious operations. As soon as he was involved, he began thinking about how he could defeat the North Koreans, and he mounted a landing at Incheon, the left hook. Marine Division was landed there. They very rapidly captured Seoul, and immediately the North Korean army was cut off from its supplies, because the way Korea is, it's very mountainous on the eastern side, but most of the roads and communications come down the west. The UN forces cut the North Korean army's supplies, and they very rapidly disintegrated. They took to the hills, many were captured. Many of them were actually South Koreans who the North Koreans had impressed. As soon as they got control of Seoul, they forced South Koreans into the North Korean army, which was a cause of great problems later. So South Korea was actually liberated very rapidly. In 3 months, it was back in UN hands. Ri was returned to Seoul. The war would have been over even before KFOR's completed its training. And North Korea's attempt to reunify the peninsula by force had failed. That was the first of the three. Okay. This is just a picture, not a very good picture, I'm afraid, of Incheon, American landing ships at Incheon. I should have mentioned that the New Zealand frigates were actually involved in the landing, because they escorted the troop ships from Japan, handed them over just before they entered into Incheon Harbour. And this is another picture of the UN Army returning, liberating South Koreans. And that's a cartoon of the time, Min Hinnick's cartoon. So, I call this the consequences of temptation. The North Korean army was completely destroyed. The US became tempted to unify the peninsula by force. The Soviets had come back to the Security Council, but they got the General Assembly to pass a resolution on the 9th of October 1950, suggesting that the whole of Korea be unified. Once again, a miscalculation, because the Chinese had already indicated that if the UN forces crossed the 38th parallel, China would intervene in their own interests. These warnings were received through diplomatic channels but were ignored. So the UN command invaded North Korea, and by November they were right up close to the Yalu River, the border between China and Korea. MacArthur then said, "I'm mounting my final offensive, my home by Christmas offensive, to end the war with a unified Korea, and all our troops can then go home." What he had failed to recognize was that there were 300,000 Chinese soldiers in Korea, North Korea, by this time. As they crossed the border into Korea, they were given a different cap with a label, with a badge for the Korean People's Volunteers. So in diplomatic terms, the Chinese settled. They're not Chinese regular forces, they're Chinese who decided to intervene themselves. It's all a fiction, of course. They were regular Chinese units. Many of them were nationalist Chinese divisions that had been taken over by the communists, and they were cannon fodder in Korea. They mounted an offensive. The UN attacked, and 2 days later, the Chinese mounted a counterattack, and the UN forces were put off guard, they were thrown into disarray by the Chinese and they panicked. It's called the big bug out. They went rapidly back down to the 38th parallel. The Chinese were using human wave attacks, no concern about how many lives were lost. But this was the end of the American attempt to unify the peninsula by force. There's some Chinese attacking. These were provided to me by the Chinese Museum when I was doing the official history. So we come now to the third attempt to unify the peninsula by force by the Chinese. I should emphasize, by this time there were some North Koreans back in the field, but they were bit players. They were at the edges of the front. The main force that we were facing in Korea by this time were Chinese People's Volunteers, and our troops, K-Force, invariably fought Chinese, not North Koreans. In April, May, the Chinese Communist General Peng decided that this was the time to drive the UN into the sea. And he mounted what was called the fifth phase offensive. And this was their big effort to win the war in Korea. One of the thrusts that the Chinese had was through a particular valley called the Kapyong Valley. And our gunners happened to be there. That was a really dramatic story of how they were up this narrow valley. They managed to extricate themselves. There were Chinese and South Korean soldiers retreating with Chinese amongst them. A very chaotic moment. We were lucky that our gunners got out. And then they took a major role in stopping the Chinese from overrunning the Australian battalion and the Canadian battalion. And effectively, they blunted the Chinese operation in this particular area. And the British, there were other thrusts. The British had another major battle as well. So these joint efforts managed to stop the Chinese. They made another attempt in May 1951 to push them forward again. But by this time, the UN command was well organized, and their artillery especially stopped the Chinese in their tracks and then began to move forward again. The communists at this point realized that they couldn't push the UN command out of South Korea, so their attempt to unify the peninsula also failed. But by now, the war was a proxy contest between the two great powers, China and the United States. Armistice talks actually began in July 1951. And that basically set in place the contact line of contact that the troops were on at that point, essentially is the one that now is the border between North and South Korea. Talks dragged on for 2 years. The communists had no incentive to actually come to terms. The war was a stalemate by now, and they were keeping the Americans involved in Korea. They wouldn't be able to operate elsewhere. It wasn't until Stalin's death that the situation changed, and Eisenhower had come in as president, and he made veiled threats to use atomic bombs against the communists. The talks had really gone on for 2 years over the future of the POWs. The UN command captured tens of thousands of prisoners when they destroyed the North Korean army. As I said before, a lot of those were South Koreans who were wearing a North Korean uniform, but they were actually South Koreans who were conscripted into the North Korean army against their will. And they didn't want to go back to North Korea. So there was a dispute over that. A lot of the Chinese prisoners were nationalist Chinese, they wanted to go to Taiwan. And the communists insisted on all prisoners going back to North Korea. So they quibbled and argued about that. Syngman Rhee, in the end, released all the South Koreans who were being held, and that broke the logjam to some extent. They eventually reached an agreement that the Chinese troops could go to, they could make a choice and go to Taiwan, or the Chinese nationalists who wanted to go to Taiwan could go to Taiwan. So the armistice was reached on the 27th of July 1953, and it created a 4 kilometer wide demilitarized zone on the line of contact, which is on the map, you can see. It's above the north, above the 38th parallel in the east, but in the west, the area that in the peninsula, the Omchun Peninsula, is now part of North Korea. In contrast to the 38th parallel, the line of contact is a defensible line. And essentially the two countries remain much the same size because the north got territory in the west and the south in the east, although South Koreans probably got slightly more. There's still a dispute as to where that line runs into the sea, and the North Koreans are very touchy about South Korean fishing boats crossing certain lines in that area west of Incheon. So there were four main outcomes of the war. Both Korean states survived and continued their opposition to each other, and they have till today. China had demonstrated its determination to prevent a unified non-communist Korea. There are disputes over how many lives the Chinese lost in Korea. I saw someone estimating 1.5 million last week, but the general figure I think is about 600,000 lives in Korea. It's 600,000 reasons why the Chinese are very interested in what happens to North Korea. The UN command remained in place and it's still there. There's no way actually to terminate it without another UN Security Council decision resolution. Until the United States is willing to terminate it, I don't think it's going to happen because they can veto any decision to terminate the command. We hear about it all the time because Donald Trump has been trying to demand payment for the troops serving in the command, which is actually authorized by the United Nations, not by the South Korean government. Most US and foreign troops were withdrawn straight after the war, but of course there's an ongoing presence, there's 40,000, I think, US troops still in South Korea. No peace settlement has been achieved, and it's still a question, it's still a subject of diplomatic maneuvering. You will have heard in the last year some of the diplomatic stuff, Trump and Kim talking about bringing an end to the war, but it's not actually as easy as that. Because there were so many powers involved, the armistice was signed by the commander of the UN forces and the North Korean general and the Chinese general. So the three countries immediately had signed the armistice who were involved, and the South Korean government, of course. So any final resolution of the war is going to involve at least four countries, probably more because the UN is involved. And New Zealand, when the armistice was signed, made a pledge with the other 16 countries that if North Korea invaded South Korea again, that New Zealand and these other countries would immediately return to Korea. So that's a commitment that still exists. Of course, nobody knows much about it now. But if the North Koreans did attack South Korea, it would be very rapidly back in the news. And it would be difficult for our government to avoid responding to what a commitment it made at the time. So I'm going to talk now a little bit about Korea, the ongoing Korean War, or at least what I saw in Korea last year. I went to Korea as part of a program they have to bring people from various parts of the world. There were 18 of us from Mongolia, Austria, Thailand, all over the world, Colombia. Only two from countries that had actually contributed forces. But the idea of the program was to tell us a little bit about current South Korean policy in regard to North Korea. We were there for a week and it included a trip to the demilitarized zone. So the briefings we received at the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs were basically focused on the South Korean president's policy of engagement and rapprochement, what we could call the revived sunshine policy that was in place 10 or 15 years ago, aimed at bringing together North Korea and South Korea. North Korea now is led by the grandson of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un, and the Moon Jae-in government. The three main goals in pursuit of its vision of a peaceful coexistence and co-prosperity. First one is to resolve the Korean nuclear issue. You know that North Korea has developed a nuclear capability. To develop sustainable inter-Korean relations and to realise a new economic community on the peninsula. So that the two leaders had a meeting on the 27th of April 2018. They signed the Panmunjom Declaration for the peace, prosperity and reunification of the Korean Peninsula. This said that there would be no more war between the two countries, they would cease all hostile acts, they would establish a peace zone on the west part of the west coast, they would cooperate for a peace treaty, they would arrange for denuclearization, and they would establish a joint liaison office in Kaesong. So the commitment to the peace zone was interesting, because that's what we saw on our trip to the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. I've been to the Demilitarized Zone twice before. In 1991, I was part of a party of veterans who were on a visit back to Korea. South Koreans have been very generous in inviting back people from New Zealand and other countries that fought in the war. So I was allowed to go along with these veterans. And I must say, I learned more about the war in 2 weeks in the bus with them than 3 months of reading about it. But I went to the DMZ in 1991, and it was a very grim place. And so it was still grim in 2001. There was a military presence everywhere. There were tanks, artillery, big concrete things ready to roll down onto the road to block them. There was an air of tension at Panmunjom. The South Koreans were standing like gunslingers with their hands out ready to grab their guns, and they were standing with half of their bodies out from the wall. It was very, very strange. This is a tank park that we passed in 1991. There were tank parks everywhere. And that's an artillery position. You can see them in the camouflage. This is Panmunjom, the main meeting place where Trump and Kim crossed the line with each other. But that's what I'm talking about, those soldiers standing halfway, they have their body covered. Before I went to Korea, the Korean ambassador told me that I'd find everything very different, and he was right. I struggled to see any sign of military I never saw a machine gun until we were right at the DMZ and a couple of South Korean soldiers walked past patrolling the southern fence. There were no tank parks. The watchtowers along the Imjin River, we drove along the river, but North Korea is only 2 or 3 kilometres on the other side of the river, and there were watchtowers every 100 yards, barbed wire, but there was no one in the watchtowers anymore. Of course they've got cameras, but it was a totally different scene to 1991. The demilitarized zone has become a tourist area. We went up to a place called Observation Point Dora and looked over into North Korea, which was, you couldn't really see much, but then they took us to a tunnel that the North Koreans had built under the DMZ. In 1991 I went there and we walked right to the end and there was a solitary South Korean soldier looking very miserable standing at the block, which was just sandbags. Now they've got 3 concrete walls blocking the tunnel. And this is at the, on the right you can see where the tunnel was. This is the southern fence of the DMZ. The actual border is somewhere in between. You can see on the far side the other fence. They took us to just below the fence was, we went to a railway station that the South Koreans have built, which is just waiting for the connection with North Korea, and then you'll be able to take the train all the way from Busan to Lisbon. They've even got the map up, the train line already there. It's a state-of-the-art railway station with no trains. So what is going to happen in the future? We've all seen the Trump Kim nonsense that's been going on, which was inevitably going to fail. The North Koreans will never give up their nuclear weapons. They've been very adept diplomatically for 20 years in developing their program while stalling any resistance to it. There are major question marks now whether President Moon's sunshine policy can work. Last June, you may recall that the North Koreans blew up the liaison office that was part of the deal that they agreed. A very deliberate act and basically telling the South Koreans that there is no deal in prospect. The North Koreans, of course, are under strict sanctions, so there was an interest for them in trying to reach an agreement with South Korea. But unless the Americans agreed, sanctions would continue. What they've done is make North Korea one of the most capitalist places in the world. People of North Korea, to survive, have had to become very entrepreneurial. Buying and bartering and selling anything that they could find, a lot of it coming across the border from China. So it's not likely that North Korea is going to collapse because of the sanctions. It's not likely that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear weapons. And it's not likely that there's going to be a peace settlement because of the likely complications. As I said before, it would need the agreement of 4 powers. And I would argue that the United Nations would also have to agree to any agreement. It is possible that the two Koreas, or it was until the liaison office was blown up, the two Koreas might declare that the war is over, which wouldn't be quite the same thing as peace settlement. But I think the rising tensions are really making that unlikely in the immediate future. So I will stop there and answer any questions.
Questions? Very interesting situation. I'll kick off and say, look, there's three generations since the war, and looking at the economic situation in North Korea, the people are starving, undernourished, but they are so entrenched. What do you think the outcome is likely to be? And, you know, do you think that they'll get together and actually declare peace themselves?
No, I don't think
so.
No.
So you don't think the economic situation and the sanctions and everything else?
Well, we were taken to talk to experts on North Korea, but they didn't think that there was going to be an immediate collapse of North Korea.
Yeah.
As I said, the North Koreans were in a famine in the 90s, and they, at that time they had to become, if they didn't want to starve, they had to find food somewhere. Mm. So they became very adept at, as I said, buying, selling, and bartering,
yep,
to get what they needed, and smuggling across the Chinese border. And let's face it, the Chinese do not want the North Korean government to collapse.
No.
We don't know what's being sent over the border
from China
to make sure they don't. It's not in China's interests for Korea to unify.
Yep.
For them, it's the status quo means that they dominate that area. Having a unified Korea in the middle with nuclear weapons, that's not an outcome the Chinese would want.
Right. I'm just looking at the the European situation with Eastern European and the situation back in the sort of the 80s before the Berlin Wall came down and sort of communism broke down within Eastern European, and the two Germanys got back together again. I mean, it took a heck of a long time, a lot of protests by a lot of people died in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's a classic example of where communism has broken down, and then, 1989, you had the Soviet Union collapsing.
Yeah, but the North Korean regime was much stronger.
Yeah, so
it was never going to collapse immediately. And it was more keen on building nuclear weapons and feeding its people.
Right.
And that attitude remains. I don't see any easy or immediate solution. And President Biden will not meet with Kim Il-sung because that actually gave him legitimacy. He didn't need to get anything. All he had to get was the meeting. It was a disaster, total disaster. And even Trump's advisors, who have written books about it, also John Bolton, calls it a disaster. Anyone who knew anything about the Korean Peninsula knew that that would be a disastrous way to try and get an agreement. Kim Jong-un was never going to agree to dismantle his nukes. So we're still with a stalemate, and it may continue. Even if the two countries did unite, it would take decades for them to. They couldn't allow it. They'd have to keep the demilitarized zone to prevent North Koreans pouring into South Korea and destabilizing South Korea.
No-win situation.
Historically, there were two kingdoms in Korea, so the situation at present is not historically completely unheard of. If you go back 1,000 years.
Sure. Interesting. Must be
You never mentioned the Ho Min Trail. Is that the same place?
No. Ho Chi Minh Trail was for the Vietnam War.
Was it?
The Chinese supported their armies in Korea just by crossing the Yalu River. But of course, the American Air Force destroyed every building almost in North Korea. So the Chinese soldiers were in dire straits at the front because the supplies were interrupted by air power.
Well, South Korea is not very prosperous now, we've seen.
Well,
there is there now. A friend of mine went there for a holiday.
Well, the veterans I went with in 1991 were gobsmacked at South Korea now because they remembered it as downtrodden, lots of destruction. Now it's a vibrant, amazing place because of the transport system alone, the train systems. You get on a train at Pusan, you get to Seoul in about an hour. Most of the time you're underground, going through tunnels, straight through hills. So it's a remarkable country. And the veterans were pretty gratified to see how Korea had developed.
What
yep,
was the name of the two frigates that
went to
New Zealand
frigates?
Tutira and
Pukaki.
Pukaki, that's right.
Is
yeah.
Anybody in the audience were on those?
No. No, not here today. No, yep.
Why was there such a failure of American military intelligence to detect the entry of the Chinese into the war?
Well, MacArthur didn't want to know about the Chinese. There were some clashes with Chinese troops in October, and they thought, oh, well, that's just a few token Chinese, and sent a few token Chinese in. They moved by night, and they didn't move by day. So the Americans had planes over the area the whole time and didn't detect the size of the Chinese force that was in North Korea. I should have mentioned there were two prongs to the advance. One was coming from Wonsan. They made another landing there. Our frigates took part in that as well. And those troops had to fight desperately to get back to Wonsan and get evacuated as the Chinese tried to cut them off. And then there was the main force in the west that just up sticks and rushed south, outpaced the Chinese. So eventually there was nothing to harass them. They just kept going until they were back at Seoul.
Does North Korea have any women diplomats, do you know? It might be time for a couple of women to get it right.
I would say that Kim Jong-un's sister is the power behind the throne there. So, no, she's not a diplomat. I think she's probably very influential. I should have mentioned that there is one New Zealander in North Korea. Our frigates patrolled the west coast, and they made some landings. They should never have done so, but they did. And one of our 19-year-old seamen was killed, and he had to be left on the beach. So we do have a diplomatic
presence.
Diplomatic job to do to finally get the North Koreans to locate his body and return it to us. He is the last unknown New Zealand soldier. He's commemorated in the Pusan Cemetery, where all of our dead from the Korean War are buried. A beautiful cemetery, and I noticed when we went there last April that they now have the names of every UN soldier who died in Korea on a wall or a series of walls, which is very impressive, I think. It's something that we should do here. We only have 28,000 war dead. We should have the names of everyone on a wall at the War Memorial. Sorry, I'm getting onto my
Any other questions? Yeah, sure. Woody.
I'm Woody Lee, originally from South Korea. I'm representative of Korean community of Palmerston North. The majority of Koreans, they wish reunification in the future. Like, it's quite different situation, like in East and West Germany, we really wish reunification. But as a war historian, your personal opinion is actually the unification will happen in the near future or still waiting for long?
Well, in international affairs, you never know what's going to happen. In October 1989, my wife and I were in Berlin, and 1 week later, the wall came down. We never had any idea while we were there that suddenly the two Germanies would reunify. So unpredictability is one one thing about international politics, you never know what's going to happen, but I would predict that the stalemate will continue for at least another 20 years. I just don't see... I mean, President Moon, his family comes from the north. I think he may have been born there himself. Gradually, the generation is passing away that were actually born in the north and have a determination to reunify the two countries.
Is this a unique country divided into two? Mm-hmm. Now, after 70 years.
70 years?
Yeah, 70 years. It's quite different, everything different.
Yes. The two curias have gone different paths. The people would take a long time to reconcile the two people now. But, as I said before, I think the Chinese are never going to allow the unification of Korea. That's not in their interests. Plus, they want that buffer and the 600,000 dead soldiers is a big reason why they wouldn't agree to a sudden reunification.
Mao's sons were killed during the...
They were killed in Korea, yes.
Dennis.
I was going to ask a question in relation to China thinking that North Korea or treating it as a buffer zone.
Yeah. Sorry, what's it?
China using North Korea as
a buffer zone. Oh, I see. Yes, buffer zone. Okay.
A lot of other countries are doing that. Have a look at Malaysia and Singapore. I would just ask you all, please, to put your hands together for Ian's presentation.